The poem I have brought you this morning is Naomi Lazard's poem, In Answer to Your Query. We are sorry to inform you the item you ordered is no longer being produced. It has not gone out of style, nor have people lost interest in it. In fact, it has become one of our most desired products. Its popularity is still growing. Orders for it come in at an ever-increasing rate. However, a top-level decision has caused this product to be discontinued forever. Instead of the item you ordered, we are sending you something else. It is not the same thing, nor is it a reasonable facsimile. It is what we have in stock, the very best we can offer. If you are not happy with this substitution, let us know as soon as possible. As you can imagine, we already have quite an accumulation of letters such as the one you may or may not write. To be totally fair, we respond to these complaints as they come in. Yours will be filed accordingly, answered in its turn. Whenever I am on a long solo camping trip, 7 days or more, I have what I call the bad day. It usually shows up around day 4 or 5, and I have grown accustomed to its arrival. The bad day is the day that I want to abandon the camping trip. If the weather is rainy, the bad day is worse. Stuck in my tent, I imagine myself cozy and dry at home. I think about what my friends are doing and how I could be with them right now. I imagine all the things that I could accomplish if I were not sitting by this stupid lake. During the bad day, I just want to pack up everything and go home. Nothing seems fun or interesting where I am. The books that I have brought fail to capture my attention. I hate my food. The bad day passes very slowly. Just to be over with it, I usually go to bed early, and I worry that the next day will be just as bad. Part of what makes the bad day bad is its lack of modern-day disruptions. Sure, ducks might swim by, the sun might peek in and out of the clouds, I might hear a beaver slap its tail in the far distance, or a chipmunk might scold me from a nearby tree. But my campsite has no electricity, so no television, no computer, no stereo. My campsite has no cell phone reception, so no calls, no texts, no Facebook. I am hours from my car with nothing to do. I can't even see what's happening in the news. On the bad day, I wonder, whose idea was it to come clear out here anyway? Evagrius, a 4th-century monk who lived in the Egyptian desert, writes of the equivalent of the bad day for him and his fellow monks. Describing the feeling of listlessness at the passing of time, Evagrius calls it the noonday demon because it appeared to him most often when the midday sun was its brightest. He says of this noonday demon, first of all, he makes it seem that the sun barely moves at all and that the day is 50 hours long. Then he constrains the monk to look constantly out the window, to walk outside the cell, to gaze carefully at the sun to determine how far it stands from the 9th hour, to look now this way and now that, to see if perhaps one of the brethren has appeared from his cell. The cleverness of this noonday demon is that he does not tempt the monk or us to do something we will regret. Rather, our malaise comes from realizing how much more of our lives we still face. Also known as acedia, this demon reminds us that we must go to work over and over for years and years more. It taunts us with the many thousands of meals we will have to cook, loads of laundry we will have to wash, sidewalks we will have to shovel free of snow, rooms we will have to vacuum. Acedia makes us regret our choices. It weighs us down with responsibility. It perfectly describes the day-to-day slog that represents so much of our lives. Acedia is at the root of all boredom, and we will do almost anything in our power to avoid feeling it. I imagine most of you, like me, have a cell phone close at hand all day, every day. Mine is in my pocket right now, carefully set with the ringer off. There's nothing more embarrassing. It is my main mode of communication. It is my timepiece and my navigator. I use it to see weather forecasts, to check my Facebook feed, to read restaurant reviews. I love my phone, and I depend on it. Nothing short of having my wallet go missing will cause me to panic more than misplacing my phone. Can I get an amen? Amen. And worse than my dependency on my cell phone for communications is my ability to not check it when it rings, pings, buzzes, or beeps. We all know how this goes. We're in a meeting, having dinner with friends, watching TV or driving, and our cell phone goes off. It vibrates or makes a sound to let us know that someone is calling, texting, or emailing us. And we simply cannot let it lie there or stay in our pockets. We have to check it. We have to see who is telling us what. Even though I've trained myself not to respond to the phone in the car, I must peek at it to see why it went off. And I get a little rush every time. But it is not just our cell phones that demand our attention. Many of us check our email many times a day. Many of us keep up with the hour-to-hour news cycle. Many of us imagine all this checking is keeping us productive and informed. Might we instead be battling our own version of that noonday demon? In his book, The Lost Art of Reading, David Ulan writes, "I can check my email in an instant, and 20, 30 times a day I do. What am I looking for? Something, everything, a way of staying on top of the information. It doesn't matter. The looking is an end unto itself. The looking is an end unto itself." In all religious traditions, the main hurdle to prayer and meditation is not the outside world. It is the jumpy nature of the human mind. Though it helps to start in a quiet, conducive spot, meditation is not about getting the rest of the world to be quiet. Meditation's goal is to quiet the mind to the noisiness of the world. Likewise, prayer does not seek to change the outside world. Rather, it seeks to change the inner world and thereby affecting our actions. And in both practices, as the mind gets more and more used to the practice of calm focus, the world slips away. Distractions cease for at least a time, and the monkey mind stops its chattering. But first, the person must set aside attachments. she must lay aside her productive modern life, at least temporarily. Those of us who stay close to our devices should ask ourselves, what keeps drawing us to them, says Jeff Vogel, professor of theology and ethics at Hampden Sydney College in Virginia. What are we looking for looking's sake, he asks. He says this may account for our often mindless use of social media, but not necessarily for our frequent visits. Why do we return again and again, as if observing a device-driven liturgy of the hours? He goes on to say, I would like to suggest that in addition to the desire to simply look, we are in pursuit of interruption. We are creating an occurrence where there was none, because we want something, anything, to happen. No doubt it's a minor foible, but it has implications for the life of faith, particularly for the life of prayer. Now, the hardest thing that most of us will ever seek is contentment. Contentment with our families, contentment with our jobs, contentment with where we live, contentment with our spouses, contentment with our ever-changing bodies. But contentment more than happiness is the true measure of the spiritual life. If we are so in the habit of pursuing interruption, as Jeff Vogel suggests, when will we ever be able to stop long enough to know what we really want? When will we ever be able to stop long enough to hear that still small voice inside? I assure you, our world is not going to get simpler in the coming years. It has every indication of becoming louder, more complex, and increasingly fraught with competing interests. Our devices are going to vibrate and ring even more than they do now. How will we adjust to the ever-increasing intrusion of these manufactured disruptions? In recent years, there's been a rise in the dystopian novel, and there are some good ones out there. I recently read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel and recommend it highly. These dystopian novels come in two types, with zombies and without zombies. I tend to prefer the ones without zombies. One of the main attractions of both types is the chance to imagine a world utterly devoid of technology. Usually these novels begin a few years after some cataclysm has destroyed most of the world's human population. Using flashbacks to give us clues to the first horrible days after the collapse of society, these novels propel us into a world without electricity, without medicine, without fossil fuels, and without laws. America is blasted back to colonial era simplicity, though it longs for the technology that it no longer has. Surviving on deer meat, post-apocalyptic Americans miss their cell phones and their iPads. But without technology, human beings must face one another. They must rely on one another. They sometimes have to fight one another. They have to live in the here and now in a way that could have been avoided just some years earlier. Now, I'm glad that these novels are just novels. I really don't want to live in a world without electricity, medicine, fuel, and laws. But much of the charm of figures like Henry David Thoreau and his Cabin by Walden Pond lies in the fantasy of life reduced to its most basic. Without the distractions of modern life, nature can speak and humanity can speak. But life as we know it is not likely to end very soon. Of course, the best course is one between utter dependence on technology and complete renunciation of it. The best course is to find balance in one's life between the tide of email and the restful inaction of meditation. Think of how delicious it was just to sit quietly with all of the people in this room during Marian's meditation. The best course lies between busyness and leisure, and my guess is that most of us could use a little more leisure. Most of us could benefit from some downtime. Quite predictably, the morning after the camping trip's bad day, I rise with a new appreciation for the simplicity of the lake shore, the simplicity of another day with nothing productive to do. When the bad day has passed, I'm no longer mad at myself for coming on the camping trip. I no longer hate my food. My books seem interesting again. And best of all, I am more at one with my surroundings. After a few days of solitude, I have often found myself feeling less separate from the water, rocks, trees, plants, and animals around me. A mystical sort of union envelops me. Time loses its rigidity. My mind calms itself. My desire for distractions fade. But this usually does not happen until after the bad day. Somehow I need to get through the bad day to reach the shore of contentment. I wonder what might happen for you as well if you were to pay less attention to your devices so that you might pay more attention to the beauty all around you. What might it be like to let your phone buzz and not look at it? What might you find when you get beyond boredom? What contentment lies close at hand? So be it. Amen.